We're on a short leash here.
This is Jyotish.
Hello.
I am Asha. This is Dave. They are going to talk to you about Autobiography of a Yogi, which probably most of you know about, one of the most influential books of our times. They have the distinction of having read it in the 60s, which some of you lived through and some of you have studied in school. Okay? But the difference from their lives was once they read it, they never looked back. And everything about their life has been defined by the experience of the spiritual energy that that book brought into the world. So what they're going to share with you today is not a college professor's idea of what might happen, but a real life experience of what did happen and what the potential and what the fruit of that kind of a life might be and how that might translate now into the world we're living in and what that message might be for this time, for this place, and for all of you. I have shared all my incarnation with these two great souls. They were there in the Ananda community when I arrived. They were the welcoming party among others. And my own life has been informed by the power of these two souls. And it gives me a tremendous pride. And you can see it touches my heart deeply to just be able to say, what an honor to be in the same room and be able to hear them speak today. So enjoy.
Thank you, Asha. As you can see, like with the mic, we're tethered together. And it's been a great joy. So as Asha said, we're going to speak about the autobiography of a yogi. Let me ask how many in this room have read that book? Whoa, how many have not read it? Just a few people. Actually, I commiserate with all the hands that went up and said, I've read that, because the few of you who haven't have the thrill of your life ahead of you. Of reading that book for the first time. It is a book that not only changed my life and Davy's life and Asha's life and all the lives of so many people. Davy and I have now talked with hundreds of people, thousands of people probably around the world that have read that book and have had their lives changed by it. Sometimes that book has come to them in basically miraculous ways, like walking into your apartment and finding the book on the coffee table with no reason to know how it got there and picking it up. Another person, you know, had it for some years and it was not something that they got around to reading, and it fell off the shelf and hit them in the head. And they figured, well, all right, maybe this is a sign. So there is a great, great power in that book, and the power to not only change a single life, but to change a civilization. I think that that book was not written. I mean, Yogananda wrote it. It was published about 6 years before his passing from the earth. He had been working on it over a period of some time, maybe 20 years or so. And the original title was not Autobiography of a Yogi. The original title was Yogi Christs of India, because he was going to, as he did in that book, he talked about the great, great souls that he had met who had the same level of consciousness, that cosmic consciousness that Jesus had, that Buddha had, that all these great souls. As he explained it, there are many, many pathways that go to the sea, but once you arrive at the sea, you're in the same ocean as all those great ones before you who have been there. And you and I are on that same journey together. It's just that maybe we're a little farther upstream and have a ways to travel. But nonetheless, we're on that journey. In fact, Yogananda said that everyone in the world is on that same journey. Everyone is on a spiritual path. Many of them are resisting it with all their might, but nonetheless, the propelling force of unity with God is what he described in that book, and that's why it had the power to change lives. Now, Yogananda, there's the Yogi Christs of India, the miracles. When you read that book, the first thing that stands out are all the miracles. Isn't that true for probably most of you who've read it? Certainly for me that was true. And coming from the background that I came from, that was an attractant and a repellent at the same time. I grew up in a little town in the Midwest, 30,000 people, southern Minnesota. In fact, I grew up in the town where they make spam rather than send spam. So this is Austin, Minnesota, with the Hormel meatpacking plant as the primary industry of the town. So the ideas of a Yogi Christ and you know, these things that I was going to read a few years after leaving that place and moving to San Francisco, they weren't even on the beginning of the horizon for my mind. Nor was religion. I had essentially dropped out of religious practices when I was 12 or 13 years old. I would have described myself at the time that I picked up the autobiography as an agnostic at best. And so as I started reading that and started coming across all of the descriptions of miracles, you know, on page 8, the first one comes in. This man appears in a field of grass to Yogananda's father. It turns out to be Lahiri Mahashaya, a great soul. But nonetheless, page 8, you're reading along, and this man appears. But one thing about the miracles, in many cases I had to set those on a shelf because I wasn't yet ready to accept them. So appearing in a grass field, having two bodies, levitating, resurrecting after death, creating a golden palace in the Himalayas. That honestly was beyond the scope of experience for somebody from Hormel meatpacking plant surroundings. And so I was on a quest. I was on a quest from quite a young age to understand consciousness, not religion, but consciousness. And that's what first drew me to that book, was that it promised to give me a glimpse into consciousness and the scope of consciousness that was beyond anything that I had experienced, but that I hungered for and I yearned to learn about. And so I began reading that book, and as probably happened with most people, I could barely put it down. So once you begin on that book, if it catches you, and it doesn't always catch everyone right at the beginning, depends on a lot of factors, but if it catches you, then you're propelled to continue reading through it. And so all of these miracles I had to put on a shelf, but there was an authenticity to Yogananda's writings that I simply could not deny. You know, this was not somebody saying that their grandfather's fifth cousin once had a teacher who told him about levitation or bilocating. This was Yogananda talking about his father who saw that, or he himself saw those miracles, or what really gave it the power, although he didn't talk about this very much, but what really gave it the power is he did those miracles. He himself levitated. He himself resurrected someone from the dead. Many, many of those miracles that he talks about in the autobiography, he himself did, but he doesn't shine the light on himself. He shines the light on the consciousness and the potential that we all have. And he does that for a very important and clear reason. He doesn't want to shine the light on himself and make it seem like he is different from us. So as you read that book, you kind of have this thought in the back of the mind, oh, he was really lucky. He really lucked out. He got to go and had a neighbor who could levitate. Or he you know, had this interest, and he just found somebody who propelled that along. It took me some time to understand the depth of his consciousness, the breadth of his consciousness, because everything that he talked about in that book, Autobiography of a Yogi, he himself experienced. So these, what, as I say, the miracles, I kind of had to put many of them on the shelf because I couldn't relate to them. But what I was really interested in was the potential for the scope of human consciousness. The chapter, An Experience in Cosmic Consciousness, where he feels the body and the breath become stilled and his consciousness begins to spread out, and he can see through walls and he can feel the roots of plants, and it continues to spread and spread until it's a cosmic consciousness. Now that I could relate to, not that I had experienced it, but that I was hungry to experience it. And the fact that it was the authentic experience of the author gave it a power. Later on, I understood that he told Swami Kriyananda. Swami Kriyananda, when he first met Yogananda, expressed how powerful that book was and how meaningful and how it had changed Swami Kriyananda's life. Most of you know the story, but for those of you who don't, Swami Kriyananda read it in 1948 in New York and basically got on the next bus, traveled across country, and became Yogananda's disciple. Now, that is the kind of potency that Yogananda put in that book. So when Swami Kriyananda complimented Yogananda and talked about how powerful it was, Yogananda's response, that's because I put my vibrations in it. Now, Swami Kriyananda didn't know really what he meant by that, but of course, later on he learned. But that book is not just words on a paper. It has the vibration. When he talks that chapter on cosmic consciousness, when you read that, you have the vibration of that experience, even though you don't really experience it yourself yet. But you understand that there's something there and something touches the heart. So that consciousness and the vibrations that were in that book is what sparked the revolution spiritually in America. Now, it wasn't the first step. Yogananda came to America in 1920, and it took him, oh, 2 or 3 years to get established on the East Coast in Boston. And then he began to lecture in larger and larger venues. So he went to New York and he lectured in Carnegie Hall and he filled up Carnegie Hall. And then he went across country filling the largest auditoriums in the country. And so we read that he did that and we think, oh, he must have been a really good speaker. You know, somebody probably we would think today a kind of a motivational speaker. You know, he must have been good at that craft. But it was way beyond that. It wasn't that he would just go and lecture. He would go to a city and stay for 4 weeks or 6 weeks. And the lecture, the big lectures, were almost the least of what he did. He gave classes day after day, night after night, sometimes two or three classes a day. He said he was churning the ether, planting a spiritual vibration in the mindscape and in the landscape of America, which had never seen this kind of teaching up until then. He himself initiated probably more than 100,000 people into Kriya Yoga. But he gave classes, he gave experiences. So the autobiography of a yogi was not something that came out of a bookish scholar that was a hermit. It came out of maybe one of the greatest teachers of the meditative sciences and of spiritual consciousness ever to come here. And so it was kind of the capstone. So he churned the ether. He traveled around America and he did these classes and these lectures and had some notoriety. Not that he cared about notoriety, but you know, the bees have to know where the hive is in order to fly there and get the honey. And so that notoriety let people know where they could get his teachings and how. And he had lessons, he had written other books, but the pinnacle of it all was still yet to come, and that was coming late in his life, and it was the autobiography of a yogi. So once that was published, it didn't sell millions immediately, but it began to sell and began to be more and more widely distributed. It was eventually to sell millions. I don't know what the actual score is. You know, it's probably 15 or 20 million copies have been sold. But it's not only the copies that have been sold. It is one of those books that people say, oh, my friend, you have to read this book. I'm going to loan it to you. And so one book gets passed around and passed around and passed around. Some years ago, we were talking with an author who has just published his Yogananda's biography, Phil Goldberg, and it's a wonderful book. I recommend it. But we were talking with him, and he had talked with and interviewed many, many spiritual teachers around America. And almost every one of them said that the autobiography of a yogi was what was the catalyst that turned their life in a spiritual direction. Not all of them followed Yogananda. Not all of them had the karma that Devi and I and Asha had to quickly find a direct disciple. But basically, most spiritual teachers in America have had their lives changed or propelled in a spiritual direction by that book. And so there's a potency and a power in that to change consciousness, first on an individual level, but then on a national level, but now on a global level. Because one of the things that Devi and I do is we travel around. Ananda, when I first, well, just to give a little personal story, I first read that book in probably September or October of 1966. And so I read it, but it absolutely changed my thinking and changed what I wanted to do. But I didn't know what to do beyond that. I didn't know that there was a organization that I could go to and find lessons and so on. It was just a book that I read. And then about 6 months later, I was introduced or found the address of a direct disciple of Yogananda, and I was eager to find out more about that book and about Yogananda. So my brother-in-law and I went on Easter Sunday in 1967, and knocked on the door of this disciple who turned out to be Swami Kriyananda. So the step between reading the autobiography, finding a direct disciple, starting to take lessons, and then essentially that turned my life completely over. And the old memories of Hormel meatpacking plant and and the early days of Spam receded way, way back into the background, because Yogananda produced after that book. See, that book went out like a, I don't know, a psychic, spiritual, potent calling card. And it touched the disciples that then came to Yogananda for training. And then those disciples have gone on, most especially Swami Kriyananda, has gone on in order to take what Yogananda taught to them and gave to them and magnetized in them and then shared it. And as I said, first, when I first met him, Ananda consisted of his living room in San Francisco. And so that was all. Now Ananda has spread. We have communities up and down the West Coast in America. We have a big work throughout Europe. We have a bigger work in India and a growing work. And so that message has spread. So what Yogananda did was he brought the ancient Vedic teachings of India, and he, one might say, he re-languaged them or repackaged them in a way that fit with the age that we're in. So I think that that book was written for exactly the times that we're in right now. And in fact, one obscure little paragraph, there are so many things in that book that you simply miss until somebody points them out to you or until you've read it. You know, Davy has often said, and I agree, that we've read that book countless times. But every time we read it, Yogananda has changed it somehow. You know, he added a chapter that we didn't know was there before. He highlighted certain paragraphs. And because every time we go back to it, it seems like a different book. But there's what seems like a relatively obscure little paragraph that, here's another miracle again, that this deathless soul, Babaji, meets with Jesus Christ somewhere in the Himalayas, and they talk together, and they're aware of the restless, materialistic times that are coming to the earth, and they say that we have to have a representative who is sent to the West to bring these teachings. So that book was written for exactly the times that we find ourselves in, exactly the circumstances, the pressures, the restlessness, the electronic noise that we have around us, the politics of division that are not only here but around the world, all of these difficulties that are present in the world today, that book was written as the antidote for it. And so what has happened is that that book has planted millions of seeds, and those millions of seeds have sprouted around the world. And I'll just end by talking a little bit about the societal changes that have happened because of that. Davy and I have the opportunity to travel a lot. We travel to Italy, we travel to India, we travel around America. And we can see how much of an impact came from that book. It started probably not very much in the 1940s, because only a few disciples read it there. But in the 1960s, when I found it, it seeded a whole generation. It seeded the Beatles, it seeded a lot of people that Davey and I now talk with who said, I read that book when I was in college or when I was in a youth, and I never was able to do much about it, but I've never forgotten that book. It touched people like Steve Jobs. Most of you know that he read that book. He read it every year. It was the only book that he had on his iPad to read. And so it touched people who were destined to change the consciousness of the world. And so that seed that has gone out has sparked a revolution. And that revolution is exactly what we need in our times. And honestly, that revolution has only just begun. In another 200 years, I am convinced that people will look back and they will say that that book was one of the most important books that was ever written. So those few of you who have yet to read it, I congratulate you. And those of you who have read it again, because it's going to change and there'll be new paragraphs and new chapters in it, and you'll have another thrill ahead of you. Thank you.
We have to pause now to change mics. So
can we turn that on?
So welcome everyone, and thank you for coming to the Yogananda Fest. And it's so great to see old friends, new friends, friends from around the world. There are moments in history where a very little event happens that it changes the course of consciousness. One example happened in the late 15th century, and there were a group of men and women who were looking at the world around them, and they were mainly congregated in a small town called Florence. John Parsons, hi. Old friend, didn't see him here. They were congregated at a little town of Florence, Italy, and they began looking at the world around them, and they began seeing it in a way that no one else had ever seen. They realized there was a spatial relationship between things close up and things far away. And they called it perspective. And they began painting it, and they began sculpting it, and they began studying human anatomy, that the body wasn't just this kind of mush together, but there were delineations of skeletal structure or muscular structure. And they began, against the church law, doing autopsies and looking at the muscles. And this was the great new revolution in art, which we call the Renaissance, the rebirth. And from that, we had a revolution in how we related to space and things, objects in our world. Now we fast forward a little bit, and we get to a man living in Bern, Switzerland. He wasn't very dynamic or noticeable. His teachers thought he was a little bit dull and that he wouldn't make much of himself. And he worked in a patent office in Bern, Switzerland. But he was fascinated with what was the nature of light. And he thought about it, and he talked about it with his friends. He would sit in coffee shops, and they would talk about, I think he didn't keep a lot of friends for a long time, because he was just talking about, what is light? What is light? And in this period of time, he wrote something. He saw the world in a different way. And he wrote what has been called the formula which changed the world. And that's E=mc², that matter and energy are essentially the same thing. And this was a revolution in science and in physics. and it changed the course of human consciousness. Now we move forward. Did I mention the man's name? I think you know Albert Einstein, who was a great, not only a scientist. I love reading the quotes from Einstein. Someone asked him later in life why he, because he was brilliant, but he also had a wonderful heart and a wonderful sense of humor. Someone asked him why he was so negligent about what he wore. He didn't really care about his hair or his clothes. And he said, you know, when you are able to really understand that light is the underlying reality and you can prove it mathematically, you really don't care what color socks you wear. And it was true. But then we move forward. And the 20th century has not been a great time for humanity. First, there was the war to end all wars, the First World War, followed quickly by the Second World War. And then that ended, you can give it a date, August 1945, with the dropping of the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima. But in a way, that devastation of that one city was only a microcosm of the devastation that that war brought to the world, because it not only destroyed beauty and art and culture, but there was an incredible loss, not just in Europe. The battles weren't fought in America, but globally there was a loss of faith in God. How could God allow so much suffering? There was a loss of meaning in life, that everything was relative. How do you know what's good or bad? You can do whatever you want. There's no underlying eternal values. It was a loss of hope, a loss of faith, belief, meaning of life. What's it all about? People are born, they're brutal to each other, we die. What's it all about? It was a loss of innocence. And in its place, we are living in the fruits of that bitter tree of loss of faith, belief. It was supplanted with materialism. We'll find our security, we're going to build our little house in the suburbs, and we're going to get a big portfolio, and we're going to send our kids to college. And that's how we're going to be secure and happy, and our life will have meaning. And if we can add power and greed on top of that, all the better. And here we are today, living in the fruits of those experiences. But 1946, as Jyotish was saying, there was a man of Indian origin living in Los Angeles. He was a well-known speaker and spiritual leader, but he wrote a book. He'd been working on it, and he put his vibrations into it. Can you hand me that? I can't move very much. Thank you. And it's this book. You know, there's a wonderful science fiction novel called Fahrenheit 425 by Ray Bradbury. It's a futuristic time when all books are banned and burned and a totalitarian state, but a little group of people pull off and live in a community, and they each memorize great works of literature to preserve them. And so finally at the end, the hero escapes and he finds this village and he meets people, and people say, hello, I'm Tale of Two Cities, and hello, I'm the works of Socrates. Well, if that ever comes to pass, I'm going to be Autobiography of a Yogi. So, but everything in this book, in his quiet way, Yogananda gave us the antidote for the loss that has occurred to humanity. And it's a revolution more powerful than the revolution of the artists or the revolution of science. It's a revolution of consciousness. And, you know, there are great physicians and doctors and so forth have come forward, but the metaphysicians, those people who are curing humanity's ills of consciousness, that's what we need now. And what did he show us? Yes, the miracles. We start with that. The forward frontispiece of the book, Master quotes Jesus in the Bible, "Lest you see signs and wonders, you will not believe." And then he gave us, okay, you want to read the book, I'll give you miracles. But he doesn't leave it with that. In the wonderful chapter, The Law of Miracles, he explains how miracles are done. And it isn't just magic, it's understanding the deepest levels of reality, that matter and energy are the same thing. And many of the things Master said in the 20s, people thought he was speaking metaphorically. He said meditation can change the molecular structure of the brain, and everyone thought, oh, that's nice thinking, symbolism. Neuroscientists are finding now exactly that. Meditation changes the molecular structure of the brain far to the better, far to our benefit. But he explains that, and he quotes, it's a book of hope. He quotes often Christ saying, everything I can do, you can do. And so he's not saying, look at me. It's one of the most, if only you read this book and got the fact that it's an autobiography written from a point of view that is totally unself-focused. I've never seen anyone do that before. It's about everyone else, but not him, and it's his autobiography. And that in itself is a lesson. You can be in this world, you can accomplish tremendous things, but it doesn't have to be about you. The focus doesn't be, look what I did. It's like, look what is possible for humanity. And he's a guide to that. But then he also showed us, in this age of lack of, what's life about? Why are we here? He talks about the purpose of life that we have incarnated again and again to activate, realize our full potential, our full consciousness. Scientists say that people who study the brain, the last I heard was we use something like 10% of the brain. Well, what are we doing with the rest of that 90%? It's just sort of waiting for us to say, who am I? What is my potential? What can I do with this consciousness that I've been given? It's far more than I know right now. And so he gives us a vision of why we are here, to realize who and what we really are. And that gives us a purpose and a direction. And he shows us that life is not without values, that there are eternal values. In India, they're called Sanatana Dharma, the eternal religion. But it's not about religion. It's about the underlying truth, which is at the core of reality, the core of all creation. And we can try, by realizing within ourselves our own worth, we can begin to realize that there is a reality, that truth within myself is true outside everywhere. I've talked to many people, and people who are spiritual leaders, who are so discouraged now by what's going on. And we say to them, this is a moment in time. Truth, Swami has a beautiful song. The lyrics are, the world can change and disappear, but truth can never die. And the truth of the underlying reality of this world is one of harmony, is one of peace, is one of unity of people, of acceptance of diversity, rejoicing in diversity. And Yogananda shows these truths. Don't give up. Don't give up yet. Hang in there. There'll come a time when people everywhere realize this. So join the forces. I've shared this with some of you before, but one of my favorite scenes in modern movies is the scene from the movie Gandhi, where he's starting the march to the sea to get salt, And it's done so well. At first it just shows Gandhi, you know, and he's starting on his march with that, you know, unique posture and carriage and his little staff and his little sandals, and he's marching off and there's two or three people behind him, and then the camera pans back and there's dozens and hundreds and thousands, and we are a part of that movement. I'm reading a book, wonderful book that some friends of mine from Chennai, India sent us called The Gift, and it's written by Gandhi's grandson. And someone asked Gandhi, 2 weeks before he was assassinated, what do you think will become of your philosophy after you're gone? And a wonderful quote, he said, in my life, they will follow me. In my death, they will worship me. But very few will take up my cause as their cause. It doesn't have to be that way. We can take up the cause that these great teachers have brought. We can look and we can say, my life, I want it to have meaning. I want it to have purpose. I want it to have values. I just don't know where to find them. Read and reread and meditate on the autobiography of a yogi. It brings home the point that there are values, there is meaning, there is purpose, there is reason for faith, that God has not abandoned this world, but he is so present. Every moment in every life, all the time, we're in a period of confusion now. But we need to understand, and the wonderful point that Master Yoganandaji makes in this book as well, is that happiness, where are we going to find happiness? Is it in that condo which has one extra bathroom, or that second BMW in the parking lot? No. Happiness is inside. And if you don't find it inside, you'll never find it in any other thing. And the message, his name, Yogananda, means joy, bliss through yoga. And what he is showing us is that who we are. He's holding up, one of his disciples described him as a flawless mirror. He holds up to us the best we can be. And then, not leaving us hanging, he gives us the tools and the techniques of meditation, Kriya Yoga, which you can all learn here at our Ananda Centers, and to enable us to make these realities our own. So he gives us the science of religion. He gives us the science of human awakening. And not just for one or two, as we were saying, we travel all over the world and we meet people. And one of the great joys of our life is to watch people over the years as they take up the practice of meditation. 5 minutes a day, 10 minutes a day. Don't think I don't have the time. If you have the time to brush your teeth, you have the time to meditate. And watching them change, and watching them flourish and flower, and the freedom they find within themselves. It's all there. And the autobiography is that we often use the phrase that sparked a revolution, but not only sparked it, it fuels the revolution. It gives us the who, what, how, and when. All of it. And if we use it as a guide out of despair, out of hopelessness, out of confusion, out of feeling trapped in our life, this revolution, just like the followers of Gandhi behind him, more and more people will start to realize. When I came to Ananda, 1969, I met Swami Kriyananda and just a handful of other people, three or four, that's all that was there. But when I met them, I thought, whatever these people have, I want, and I want it more than anything else I could possibly attain in life. So if you, in hearing the talks you'll hear today and looking at the books and meeting people, talking, sharing, if there's anything of value, that you find in your experience of this Yogananda Fest, go for it, reach for it. Don't hide from the light, but say, the world, and this is the truth, the world needs your light now. Just as much as it needed Jesus Christ and Buddha, it needs the light of each soul to make this transformation of human consciousness a reality. That's why we've come. We live in a time of great challenge. But don't be afraid. I think one of the greatest things in the life that we've had is you just give up fear. You realize every step you take, there is a power guiding you, protecting you, filling you with strength and vision, and all that can be yours. You just have to reach out for it and reach out for, yes, the book, but this is just, you know, this one day, this pages and paper will be gone, but the vibrations that Yogananda put into that book, those are there for those. As Christ said, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. He who has eyes to see, let him see. Feel that vibration. Taste it. Integrate it. Absorb it. Let it transform your life. And then we will be part of the evolution of human consciousness. And we will contribute in whatever small or large way we can. But this is the fulfillment, the end of the story, for us to realize ultimately that the joy we are seeking, the meaning we are seeking, the purpose we are seeking always has been within ourselves. And this is what Yogananda came to bring us. Thank you.